investigations. The Arabs boycotted the British inquiries except to send a few of their most fanatical members in to read prepared speeches. Although Haj Amin had left the scene, the El Husseinis were still on hand. At the commissions of inquiry, the Arabs made more and more outrageous claims against the Jews, who paid 85% of all the taxes despite the fact that the yeshuv was smaller than the Arab community. And so, after another survey of the situation, the British took a new tack and recommended that Palestine be divided into two separate states. The Arabs were to get the lion's share, and the Jews a strip of land from Tel Aviv to Haifa and those parts of the Galilee they had reclaimed. The Yeshuv Central, the World Zionists, and the Jews in Palestine were tired of the continued bloodshed, the growing Arab fanaticism, and the ever more apparent British betrayal. Once, the mandate for the Jewish homeland had included both sides of the Jordan River. Now the British were offering but an iota. Yet, despite everything, the Jews decided to accept the proposal. The British pointed out to the Arabs that it would be wise to accept because the area allotted to the Jews couldn't hold many more immigrants. But the Arabs wanted nothing more or less than that every Jew be thrown into the sea. Haj Amin El Husseini was the treasure of Islam and the martyred victim of British and Zionist injustice. From Beirut, he renewed the rebellion. Taggart, who had built the British system of forts, erected an electrified barbed wire wall along the Lebanese border to stop the Mufti's thugs and arms runners. At intervals, he constructed more blockhouse forts to interlace with the wall. One of the forts on the Taggart Wall was erected above Abu Yesha and Yad El, at the site believed to be the burial ground of Queen Esther. It became known as Fort Esther. The Taggart Wall slowed the Arab infiltration, but could not stop it. The Haganah, which had contained itself so long, became very restless, and the Yeshuv began to wonder when the Yeshuv Central would let the Haganah fight. Under this growing pressure, Ben-Gurion finally agreed to listen to a plan advanced by Avadan. In turn, the Zion Settlement Society purchased a piece of land on the northern extremity of the Galilee, right on the Lebanese border, at a point where Haganah intelligence suspected most of the Arab infiltration to be taking place. Shortly after the land purchase, Ari ben Kanan and two other top young men in Haganah were called to Tel Aviv, to Avadan's secret headquarters. The bald-headed leader of Jewish defense unfolded a map and pointed out the new parcel of land. Its importance to the continuation of the Arab revolt was obvious. "I want you three boys to take command of a unit to go up to this land and build a kibbutz there. We are carefully picking 80 of our top men and 20 women to go with you. I don't have to tell you what to expect." They nodded. "We know the Mufti is going to stop everything else in an effort to run you out. This is the first time we have picked a spot for a kibbutz because of its strategic value." Sarah ben Kanan was sick at heart. For years, she had not seen her son without a whip or a gun near at hand. Now she feared this mission, as she had feared none of the others. 100 of the best members of the Yeshuv were being put into a suicidal position. Ari kissed his mother and brushed away her tears, and in his simple way said that it would be all right. He shook his father's hand and said nothing, for the understanding between them was complete. Daphna knocked on the door, and they said goodbye to her too. Daphna and Ari walked out the gates of Yad El and turned to look back briefly at the fields and at the friends who had gathered. Barak sighed and put his arm on Sarah's shoulder as the younger couple disappeared down the road.
"They want so little from life," Sarah said. "How long? How long must we go on giving him?"
Barak shook his great head, and his eyes narrowed to catch a last glimpse of his boy and Daphna.
"God asked Abraham to give his son in sacrifice.
I suppose we of the Ashuv live in that shadow. We must keep giving Ari so long as God wills it. 100 of the finest young men and women of the Ashuv went up to the border of Lebanon and placed themselves in the path of thieves and murderers. Ari ben Canaan, at 22 years of age, was second in command. They called the place Ha Mishmar, the guard post. Chapter 16. 10 trucks carrying 100 Haganah boys and girls and their equipment sped along the coastal road past the last Jewish settlement at Nacharia in northern Galilee and penetrated into territory where no Jew had gone before. 1,000 pairs of Arab eyes watched the convoy as it moved up into the foothills of the mountains on the Lebanese border below the Taggart Wall. They stopped, set out guards, and unloaded the trucks quickly. The trucks rushed back to Nacharia before dark. 100 were alone. Above them, the hills were filled with Arab marauder gangs. Behind them were 12 hostile Arab villages. They erected a small stockade, dug in, and waited out the night. By next morning, the word had spread from Hebron to Beirut. The Jews have moved into the hills. Haj Amin el-Husseini in Beirut was enraged. It was an open challenge. He swore by the beard of Allah that the Jews would be thrown into the sea. During the next few days, the Haganah force worked themselves to exhaustion, tightening the defenses of the base camp at the bottom of the hill against the attack that had to come. Each night when they weren't standing guard, Daphna and Ari fell into exhausted slumber in each other's arms. On the fourth night, the attack came. The Jews had never undergone anything like it. 1,000 Arab riflemen, flanked with machine guns, poured a steady tattoo of fire into the Jews' stockade for 5 consecutive hours from the top of the hill. For the first time, the Arabs used mortar fire. Ari and his forces lay low and waited for the Arabs to try an assault. The attack came when Arab thugs began slithering along the ground with knives between their teeth. Suddenly, 6 searchlights darted out from the stockade and swept the field. The light caught the Arabs in close. The Jews poured on a deadly counterfire, and in the very first burst shot 60 Arabs dead. The Arabs were paralyzed with fear. Ari led 1/2 the Haganah force out from the cover of the stockade in a fierce counterattack which littered the field of battle with Arab dead and wounded. Arabs who survived fled back to high ground screaming in terror. The Arabs did not attack again for a week. Nothing the Mufti could say or do could make them attack. Kawukji could not make them attack. In that first night, 3 Haganah boys and 1 girl were killed in the fighting. One of them was the commander. Ari ben Canaan stepped up to assume command. Each day the Haganah moved up the hill a few feet, consolidated the position, and waited out the night. The Arabs watched from their positions above, but never attacked during the daylight hours. By the end of a week, Ari abandoned the first base camp and had established a second camp midway up the hill. The Arabs resumed their attacks, but the lesson of the first night was still fresh. They did not try a direct assault, but were content to fire at the camp from long distances. While the Arabs remained indecisive, Ari decided to take the offensive. At the end of the second week, at dawn, he made his move. He waited until the Arabs were tired from firing all night and their guard was lax. He led 25 crack men and 10 women in a dawn attack that threw the sleepy Arabs off the top of the hill. The Jews dug in quickly while the Arabs got their bearings and reassembled for a counterattack. Ari lost 5 soldiers, but he held his position. Quickly, he fortified a lookout post on the top of the hill, which commanded a view of the entire area. By daylight, they worked feverishly to build their foothold into a fortress. The Mufti was nearly insane with rage. He changed commanders and assembled another force of 1,000 men. They attacked, but as soon as they came into close range, they broke and fled. For the first time, Jews commanded a hilltop position, and the Arabs were not going to dislodge them. Although the Arabs would not fight at close quarters and would therefore not be able to run the Haganah out, they did not intend to make life easy for the Jews. Ari's troops were constantly harassed by Arab rifles. His force was completely isolated from the rest of the Yishuv. The closest settlement was Nahariya. All supplies and even water had to come in through hostile territory by truck, and once there, everything had to be carried up the hill by hand. Despite the hardships, HaMishmar held fast. A few crude huts were erected inside the stockade, and a road was started to the bottom of the hill. Ari began night patrols along the Taggart Wall to catch infiltrators and arms runners. The Mufti's underground highway into Palestine was being squeezed shut. 90% of the Haganah force were from either kibbutzim or moshavim. Redemption was so much a part of them that they could not stay long in one spot without trying to grow something. They began farming at HaMishmar. The place had been opened in the guise of a kibbutz, and by God, they were going to make it one. Hillside farming was a new venture for them, and it was especially difficult when there was no natural water except the sparse rainfall. Nonetheless, they went at the task with the same vigor with which they had redeemed the swamplands of the Israel Valley and the eroded plain of Sharon. They terraced the hillsides and petitioned the Zion Settlement Society for money for farm tools. The Yishuv Central and the Haganah were so delighted over the success of the dogged youngsters at HaMishmar that they decided that from then on some new settlements would be selected for their strategic value in choking off the Arab Revolution. A second group of pioneers set out for another troublesome spot. This time they were Orthodox Jews. They moved deep into the Beth Sha'an Valley and built a kibbutz at the juncture of the Syrian and Transjordan borders. Their kibbutz was called Tirat Tzvi, the castle of the Rabbi Tzvi. It stood in the midst of a dozen hostile Arab towns and villages. Again, the Mufti attempted to dislodge them. But this force of religious Jews was not of the same ilk as the old pious Jews of the holy cities. As at HaMishmar, the Arabs could not defeat the Jews of Tirat Tzvi. Ari was sound asleep in his tent.
Ari, come quickly.
He threw off his blanket, grabbed his rifle, and ran after them to the south fields which were being terraced for grapevines. There was a gathering. Everyone turned silent as they saw Ari approach. He pushed through and stared at the ground. It was blood-spattered. Parts of a blue blouse were on the ground. A trail of blood led off to the hills. Ari looked from face to face. No one spoke.
Daphna, he whispered.
2 days later, her body was dumped near their camp. Her ears, nose, and hands had been amputated. Her eyes had been gouged out. She had been raped over 100 times. No one saw Ari ben Kanan weep, or even raise his voice. After Daphna's murder, he would disappear for hours at a time, returning chalky-faced and shaken. But he never displayed passion or hatred or even great anger. He never mentioned her name to anyone again. Ari accepted this tragedy in the same way that the Yishuv had learned to accept such things, not by being stirred to violence, but only by deepening his determination not to be thrown from the land. Ari ben Kanan was all soldier. 6 Arab villages near HaMishmar cringed and awaited a revenge attack. But it never came. The Jews hung on at HaMishmar, and at Tirat Tzvi, and 6 other strategically placed settlements. The new tactic was hampering the Mufti's revolt, but not stopping it. Into this hodgepodge came an English major named P. P.P. Malcolm. Major P.P. Malcolm had been transferred to British intelligence in Jerusalem at the outbreak of the Mufti's revolt. He was a loner. P.P. dressed sloppily and scorned military tradition. He thought protocol ridiculous. He was a man who could express his feelings openly and violently if need be, and he was also a man given to deep meditation for days on end, during which he might neither shave nor comb his hair. His periods of detachment came at odd times, even in the middle of the formal parades, which he hated and believed a waste of time. P.P. Malcolm had a tongue like a lash and never failed to startle those around him. He was eccentric and looked upon as an off-horse by his fellow officers. Physically, P.P. was tall and thin and bony-faced and had a slight limp. He was, all told, everything that a British officer should not be. When Malcolm arrived in Palestine, he was pro-Arab because it was fashionable for the British officers to be pro-Arab. These sympathies did not last long. Within a short period of time, P.P. Malcolm had turned into a fanatic Zionist. Like most Christians who embrace Zionism, his brand was far more intense and rabid than a Jew's. Malcolm learned Hebrew from a rabbi and spent every spare minute reading the Bible. He was certain it was in God's scheme for the Jews to rise again as a nation. Malcolm made detailed studies of the biblical military campaigns and of the tactics of Joshua, David, and especially Gideon, who was his personal idol. And finally, he became obsessed with the notion that his coming to Palestine had been divinely inspired. He, P.P. Malcolm, had been chosen by God himself to lead the children of Israel in their noble mission. Malcolm drove around Palestine in a battered second-hand jalopy, and he hiked on his gimpy leg, where there were no roads. Malcolm visited every site of every battle of biblical times to reconstruct the tactical events. Often Jew and Arab alike were stunned to see this strange creature limping along a road singing a psalm at the top of his voice and oblivious to everything worldly. It was often asked why the British command tolerated Malcolm. General Charles, the commander of Palestine, recognized quite simply that Malcolm was a genius, and one of those rare types of military rebels who pops up every so often. Malcolm laughed at the British handbooks on war, had nothing but disdain for their strategy, and for the most part thought the entire British army was a waste of money. No one ever seemed to win an argument with him, for he never appeared to be wrong, and he was convinced of his own infallible judgment. One day toward evening, P.P. Malcolm abandoned his car when it blew two tires at once and hiked along the road toward Yad El. As he entered the defense perimeter, half a dozen guards headed in on him. He smiled and waved at them. "Good work, chaps," he called. "Now, be dear lads and take me to Barak Ben Canaan." Malcolm paced up and down Barak's living room. His appearance was even more slovenly than usual. For a solid hour he lectured Barak Ben Canaan about the glory and beauty of Zionism and the destiny of the Hebrew nation. "I like Jewish soldiers," Malcolm said. "The Hebrew warrior is the finest, for he fights and lives close to ideals. This land is real to him. He lives with great glories all around him. Your chaps in the Haganah probably constitute the most highly educated and intellectual, as well as idealistic body of men under arms in the entire world. Take the British soldier," Malcolm continued. "He's a stubborn fighter, and that is good. He responds to discipline, and that is good. But it ends right there. He's a stupid man. He drinks too much. He would sleep with a pig, and often does. Ben Canaan, that is what I've come to see you about. I am going to take your Haganah and make a first-class fighting organization out of it. You've got the best raw material I've ever laid eyes on." Barak's jaw dropped. Malcolm looked out the window. He could see the water sprinklers whirling in the fields, and in the distance he could see Abu Yashar, nestled in the hills below the Taggart Fort, Fort Esther.
See that fort up there? Esther, you call it?
Stupidity, I call it.
All the Arabs have to do is walk around it. The British will never learn.
Malcolm began humming Psalm 98 and singing the words softly in Hebrew.
I have the Psalms memorized up to 126. It comforts me.
Major Malcolm, just what is the nature of this visit? Barak said.
Everyone knows that Barak ben Canaan is fair and non-partisan. Frankly, most Jews like to talk too much. In my Jewish army, they won't have 10 words to say. I'll do all the talking.
You have made me quite aware that you like to do all the talking, Barak said.
Malcolm grunted, and continued to look at the lush fields of Yad El through the window. Suddenly he swung around, and his eyes were ablaze with the same intensity Barak had often seen in his brother Akiva.
Fight! Malcolm cried. That is what we must do. Fight! The Jewish nation is destiny, Ben Canaan. Destiny!
You and I are in certain agreement about the destiny of the homeland. I don't need refreshing.
Yes, you do. All of you do. So long as you stay buttoned up in your settlements. We must go there and start punishing those infidels. If an Arab comes out of his coffee house and takes a pot shot at a kibbutz from 1,000 yards distant, he thinks he's a brave man. The time has come to test these bloody heathens. Hebrews, that's what I want. Hebrew soldiers. You arrange an appointment with Avadan for me at once. Englishmen are too stupid to understand my methods.
As suddenly as this strange man had appeared at Yad El, he left. P.P. Malcolm limped through the gates, singing a biblical psalm at the top of his voice, and left Barak ben Canaan scratching his beard and shaking his head. Barak later phoned Avadan, and they spoke in Yiddish in case the line was being tapped.
"Who is this man?" Barak asked. He walked in like the Messiah and began preaching Zionism at me.
We have reports on him, Avadan said. Frankly, he is so odd we don't know what to make of him.
Can he be trusted?
We don't know.
Major P.P. Malcolm now spent all his free hours among the Jews. He candidly observed that British officers were idiots and bores. In a matter of months, he was known by the entire yeshuv. Although he moved in the highest circles, most of the leaders treated him like a harmless eccentric.
Our mad Englishman, he was called with affection.
Soon it became apparent that P.P. Malcolm was not mad. In close discussion, Malcolm had the persuasive power to talk the devil out of his horns. Members of the yeshuv came away from his home certain they had been under a magic spell. After nearly 6 months of evasions, Malcolm burst into Ben-Gurion's office in the Yeshuv Central Building in Jerusalem one day, unannounced.
Ben-Gurion, he snapped, you are a goddamned fool. You waste all your time talking to your enemies, and you haven't 5 minutes to spare for a friend.
With that blunt announcement, he turned and walked out. Malcolm's next appointment was with General Charles, the military commander. He argued to convince the general to let him work out some of his theories on Arab warfare with the use of Jewish troops. General Charles was pro-Arab, as was most of his staff, but the Mufti's rebellion was beginning to make him look ridiculous. Little by little, the British had trained and armed their own Jewish police and had ignored the Haganah arms which supplemented their own forces. The British had failed so badly, he decided to let Malcolm go ahead. Malcolm's jalopy showed up at Ha-Mishmar, where guards took him up the hill to Ari. The strapping Haganah commander studied the scrawny Englishman before him with puzzlement. Malcolm patted his cheek.
You look like a good boy, he said. Listen to me, obey my orders, observe what I do, and I'll make a first-class soldier out of you. Now, show me your camp and fortifications.
Ari was perplexed. By mutual agreement, the British had stayed out of Hamish Mar and turned their backs on Ari's patrols. Yet they had every legal right to enter Hamish Mar. Major Malcolm completely ignored Ari's suspicions and obvious attempt to show him only half the layout.
"Where is your tent, son?"
In Ari's tent, P.P. Malcolm stretched out on the cot and meditated.
"What do you want here?" Ari demanded.
"Give me a map, son,"
he said, ignoring Ari's question. Ari did so. P.P. Malcolm sat up, opened the map, and scratched his scraggly beard.
"Where is the key Arab jump-off base?"
Ari pointed to a small village some 15 kilometers inside Lebanon.
"Tonight, we shall destroy it," Malcolm said calmly.
That night, a patrol of 8 men and 2 women crossed over from Hamish Mar into Lebanon with Malcolm in command. The Jews were astounded at the speed and stamina with which he could push his fragile body through the steep and tortuous hills. He never once stopped for rest or to check directions. Before they left, Major Malcolm had heard someone sneeze and had said he could not go, and that anyone who did not keep up with the pace would be thrashed within an inch of his life. He led them in singing a psalm and lectured them on the nobility of their mission. As they neared their objective, Malcolm went up ahead to reconnoiter the village. He returned in half an hour.
"As I suspected, they have no security up. Here is what we shall do."
He drew a hasty map to pinpoint what he believed to be the 3 or 4 huts belonging to the smugglers.
"I will take 3 of you chaps into the village, and we will open fire from short range and give them a blast or two of grenades to loosen the party up a bit. Everyone will flee in wild disarray. My force will drive them to the edge of the village here, where you, Ben Canaan, shall establish an ambush. Be so good as to bring a pair of prisoners, for this area is obviously loaded with arms caches."
"Your plan is foolish. It will not work," Ari said.
"Then I suggest you begin walking back to Palestine," Malcolm retorted.
That was the first and the last time Ari ever questioned the wisdom of P.P. Malcolm. The man's certainty was gripping.
"Never question my judgment again, young man," he said.
Malcolm's plan was executed. The major led a 4-man squad right up to the suspected headquarters. 4 grenades were lobbed into the huts and followed by rifle fire. According to Malcolm's prediction, there was a panic. He coolly drove the thugs right at Ari's ambush. It was all over within 10 minutes. 2 prisoners were taken to the major.
"Where are your guns hidden?"
he asked the first one in Arabic. The Arab shrugged. Malcolm slapped the Arab's face and repeated the question. This time the Arab pleaded his innocence, as Allah was his judge. Malcolm calmly took out his pistol and shot the Arab through the head. He turned to the 2nd prisoner.
"Where are your guns hidden?" he asked.
The 2nd Arab quickly revealed the location of the arms.
"You sons and daughters of Judea have learned many valuable lessons this night," Malcolm said. "I will explain them to you in the morning. 1 thing, never use brutality to get information. Get right to the point."
The news of Malcolm's raid had a sobering effect on all of Palestine. For the Yishuv, it marked a historic occasion. For the very first time, the Jews had come out of their settlements to make an offensive action. Many thought it was long overdue. The British were in an uproar. Most of them demanded that P.P. Malcolm be removed at once. General Charles was not so sure. British methods of fighting Arabs were sorely lacking, and he felt Malcolm had most of the answers. For the Mufti's thugs and the Husseinis and the Muslim fanatics, it was a day of reckoning. No longer could they rove at will and pick their places for attack without expecting retribution. Ari went out with P.P. Malcolm on 12 more raids deep into Lebanon. Each raid was more successful than the last. The marauder gangs, the thugs and the gunrunners, and Kawukji's mercenaries were shaken from their complacency, for their activities were no longer profitable or safe against the swift, merciless raids of the Khaganah. The Mufti placed a reward of 1,000 pounds sterling on P.P. Malcolm's head. After Malcolm and his Khaganah boys and girls at Hamish Mar succeeded in quieting down the Taggart line, he moved his headquarters to the kibbutz of Ein Or. Malcolm requested from the Khaganah 150 top soldiers. He specifically wanted Ari ben Kanan, whom he greatly favored. At kibbutz Ein Or, Malcolm formed his raider unit. When the 150 soldiers had assembled from all over the Yishuv, Major Malcolm led them on a long hike to Mount Gilboa, at the traditional site of the grave of the great Hebrew judge and warrior, Gideon, who was Malcolm's idol. At Gideon's grave, he stood before his charges and opened his Bible and read in Hebrew. So Gideon and the 100 men that were with him came unto the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch, and they had but newly set the watch. And they blew the horns, and brake the pitchers that were in their hands. And the three companies blew the horns, and brake the pitchers, and held the lamps in their left hands, and the horns in their right hands, to blow withal. And they cried, The sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And they stood every man in his place round about the camp, and all the host ran and cried and fled. Malcolm closed the Bible. He walked back and forth with his hands clasped behind him and seemed to look off into space as he spoke. Gideon was a smart man. Gideon knew the Midianites were an ignorant and a superstitious people. Gideon knew he could play on their primitive fears, and that they could be frightened by noise and by the night. Gideon knew it, and so do we. The Arabs never knew where or when the raider unit would strike next. Their old reliable spy system simply did not work against Malcolm. He would send three units out in three different directions to confuse them. He would pass an Arab village and double back and strike it. He would send a convoy of trucks down a road and drop men off one at a time. During the day, they lay hidden in the ditches at the roadside, and at night they would assemble. Every attack that came sounded like 1,000 men. He never failed to send his enemy into a panic. He elaborated on something his Jews already knew, the terrain of Palestine. He taught them the strategic as well as the historic value of every wadi and hill and tree by pointing out how the ancient Hebrew generals had used the land and the knowledge of it to great military advantage. Ari ben Kanan became a devoted disciple of this eccentric Englishman, as did all of the raiders. He went alongside Malcolm in 100 raids against the enemy, and never once was Malcolm guilty of error. It was almost as though he were divinely guided as well as divinely inspired. He created a flawless text on Arab fighting. He demanded iron discipline and fanatical and unquestioning devotion in payment for victory after victory. The raider unit put a fear into the Arabs which was even greater than that of the Husseinis. With 150 men, he ripped the rebellion to shreds. The marauders began to flee, and Kawukji's Grand Army of Liberation raced back to Lebanon. In floundering desperation, the Mufti turned his fire on the oil line which ran from the Mosul fields to Haifa.
20,000 of those dunder-headed Englishmen could not defend that pipeline, Malcolm said. We will do it with our raider unit. Our plans are simple. Each time there is a break in the line, the nearest Arab village to that break will be attacked and flattened by the raider unit. This will teach the Arab villages to guard the lines against marauders in the interest of their own safety, and it will teach them not to shelter those thugs. Reprisal. Remember that, for the Jews are outnumbered. We must use the principle of reprisal.
Every time the Arabs moved, they got it right back in the teeth. Reprisal, from then on, became the key to Jewish defense. The Arab revolt petered out and died. It had been a miserable and costly failure. The Arabs had bankrupted their entire community and murdered their foremost spokesman. 3 years of riots and bloodshed had put them on the brink of destitution. In all that time, they did not displace a single Jewish settlement or keep some 50 new ones from going up. With the death throes of the Arab uprising, Whitehall made a clean sweep of their government in the Mandate. Major P.P. Malcolm was told he must leave Palestine, for his continued consorting with the Jews now would cause them nothing but embarrassment. Malcolm had been the greatest single instrument in breaking the backs of the Arabs. The Jews he trained were the nucleus of a greater new army. His brilliant tactics, their military Bible. For the last time, Major P.P. Malcolm stood before his Jews at Ein Ohr. The raider unit, honored by red badges on their blue farmer's clothing, stood at attention, and there were tears in the eyes of many. Malcolm opened his Bible.
Gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O most mighty, with thy glory and thy majesty, and in thy majesty ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteousness.
He walked away quickly to the waiting car. His heart was broken. The Yishuv had bestowed upon him the greatest honor they could give a non-Jew. They called him the Friend. Ari ben Kanan returned to Yad El after the raider unit was disbanded. His heart seemed always on a lonely hill on the Lebanese border where Daphna lay in eternal sleep alongside 20 other Haganah boys and girls who had fallen for Hamish Mar. With things quiet and safer, Taha left Yad El, where he had lived all this time under the protection of the Ben Kanan family, to assume the job of Mukhtar of Abu Yesha. Both Barak and Sarah realized that in the 18 months Taha had lived with them, he had fallen in love with Yordana, who was now past her 13th birthday. Love of a younger girl was not uncommon among Taha's people. Both of the parents never spoke a word about it and hoped that the boy would get over it without too much pain. The new British administration, under the command of General Havenhurst, came to Palestine. They soon rounded up the raider unit men. The latter were hauled into court and thrown into jail for terms of 6 months to 5 years. The charge, illegal use of arms. Ari and 100 other Haganah members of Malcolm's raider unit were locked in the dungeon-like Akka jail. Many of them regarded their plight as rather humorous and spent their days frustrating the British guard by singing Haganah marches and songs of the fields from morning to night. It was a thick-walled old castle, clammy and monstrous and filled with lice and rats and slime and darkness. Ari was released in the spring of 1939. He returned home to Yad El, pale and gaunt. Sarah cried in the sanctity of her room after she had seen him. What had her son had from birth but a whip and a gun and tragedy? His Daphna was dead and so many of his comrades were dead. How long would it go on? Sarah vowed she would keep her boy at Yad El forever. With Havenhurst commanding Palestine with an iron fist and open anti-Jewish sentiments, the stage was set for the final British betrayal. There was another commission of inquiry. The 3 years of Mufti-inspired bloodshed were blamed on Jewish immigration. Whitehall and Chatham House and Neville Chamberlain, their prime minister and renowned appeaser, shocked the world with their pronouncement. The British government issued a white paper on the eve of World War II, shutting off immigration to the frantic German Jews and stopping Jewish land buying. The appeasers of Munich, who had sold Spain and Czechoslovakia down the river, had done the same to the Jews of Palestine. Chapter 17. The Yishuv was rocked by the white paper, the most staggering single blow they had ever received. On the eve of war, the British were sealing in the German Jews. The Maccabees, who had been dormant, suddenly sprang to life. The white paper brought Jews into the Maccabees by the hundreds. They lashed out in a series of raids, bombing a British officers' club in Jerusalem and terrorizing the Arabs. They raided a British arsenal, and they ambushed several convoys. General Havenhurst completely reversed all previous policies of semi-cooperation with the Jews. The Jewish police were disbanded, and the Haganah was driven underground. Leaders of the Yishuv Central and more former raider men were hauled into court and then thrown into Akkor jail. Ben-Gurion again called upon the Yishuv to show the same wisdom and restraint they had shown in the past. He publicly denounced the terror tactics. But even as he spoke, there were elements within Haganah who wanted to come into the open and fight. Fearing a showdown would lead to its destruction, Avadan was again forced to hold his army in check. Barak Ben-Kanan was sent to London to join Dr. Chaim Weizmann and the other Zionist negotiators in trying to force a reversal of the white paper. But the men in Whitehall were determined not to revoke it, and thereby incite the Arabs. In Palestine, the Husseini mob was busy again. Despite the fact that Haj Amin was still in exile, the rest of the clan was still handling opposition through assassination. The Higher Arab Committee was grabbed by the Mufti's nephew, Jamal Husseini. Within Germany, the Jewish situation was beyond despair. The Zionists' organizations were on the verge of collapse as even the most complacent German Jews panicked to get out of the country. The British were making it as difficult for certain Jews to leave Palestine as for Jews to get in from Germany. They realized that anyone with a Haganah and Aliyah Bet background was a potential agent. When Ari left Palestine on orders from Avadan, he had to slip over the Lebanese border at Hamishmar and hike to Beirut on foot. He carried the passport and visa of a Jew who had recently arrived in Palestine as a tourist. In Beirut, Ari caught a boat for Marseille. In another week, he showed up in Berlin at Zionist headquarters at number 10 Meinecke Straße. His orders were, get as many Jews out as possible. When he arrived in Berlin, Zionist headquarters was a scene of panic and chaos. The Germans were playing the visa market for all it was worth. The more desperate the Jews became, the higher the price for their freedom. Many families turned over entire fortunes for the privilege of being able to escape from Germany. Visas were forged and stolen. Visas were life. The first cruel fact of life was that few countries of the world wanted the German Jews. They simply closed their doors. If they did give visas, it was with the understanding that the Jews would not come to their countries. Ari was faced with the decision of deciding who got the visas and who didn't. Each day he was the victim of threats or the object of bribes and desperate pleas. The Zionist rule of thumb was to get the children out. For 5 years, the Jews had appealed to their German numbers to leave Germany. Along with the children, there were essential scientists, doctors, professionals, and artisans, the very cream of the society. Ari and the Aliyah Bet were moving them in mere hundreds, while thousands were being trapped. He decided on a desperate gamble in an attempt to get several thousand visas at one time. That way, Ari reckoned, he could at least move the essentials and many children out. He alerted Aliyah Bet in France to be prepared either to receive these thousands or to expect his own disappearance to a concentration camp. Ari then went into negotiations with high Nazis to sell them the idea of issuing exit permits in larger numbers. He argued with a strange but fascinating logic. Britain and Germany were both trying to win Arab favor. Ari pointed out that the more Jews who got to Palestine, the more embarrassed the British would be. How paradoxical that the Alia Bet was teaming up with the Nazis in an effort against the British. Ari quickly had training farms set up in the Berlin area under Gestapo protection. In addition to all the visas he could buy, steal, bribe, and otherwise wangle, Ari built an underground railroad right under the Germans' noses for getting out the top-priority Jews. But these people, mostly scientists, escaped only in twos and threes. During the fear-filled summer of 1939, he worked around the clock as the time ran out. Meanwhile, in London, Barak Ben-Kanan and the other negotiators worked the clock around, too. They spoke to members of parliament, ministers, or anyone who would listen to them. But do what they might, the British would not budge from their immigration policy. In mid-August, Ari received an urgent message from Alia Bet in France. Leave Germany at once. Ari ignored the cable and continued his work, for each day now seemed a race against death. Another cable came. This time it was a Haganah order for him to leave. Ari gambled on just 72 hours more, for he was working on a stack of visas to get a trainload of children into Denmark. A third cable came, and a fourth. As the trainload of children crossed the Danish frontier, Ari Ben-Kanan made his own escape. He left Germany 48 hours before Hitler's Wehrmacht rolled into Poland and ushered in World War II. Ari and Barak Ben-Kanan returned to Palestine from their separate missions. Both men were exhausted, and both of them were crushed by despair. At the outbreak of war, it took only 10 minutes for the Jewish leaders to announce their course of action. Ben-Gurion urged the Yishuv to come forth for duty in the British Army to fight the common enemy. There was additional encouragement from the Haganah, which saw this as an opportunity to train its men legally. General Havenhurst, the Palestine military commander, raised strong objections with the War Office about letting Palestinian Jews into the British Army.
If we train Jews now and give them combat experience, we will only be spiting ourselves, for surely we will have to fight the very same Jews later on.
Within a week after the war began, 130,000 men and women, one out of four in the entire Yishuv, had signed up at Yishuv Central to volunteer for the British Army. As for the Arabs, most of the Arab world looked upon the Germans as their liberators and waited for them. It was impossible for the British to ignore the Yishuv's offer. It was also impossible not to heed General Havenhurst's warning. The War Office decided upon the middle road of accepting Palestinian Jews but keeping them out of frontline assignments so that they could not get actual weapons training and combat experience. The Palestinians were turned into service units, transportation and engineering battalions. Yishuv Central protested angrily against the discrimination and demanded equal opportunities fighting the Germans. The Yishuv had presented a solid front, except for the dissenting Maccabees. Avedan decided to swallow his pride, and through a chain of underground contacts asked for a meeting with Akiva. The two men met in a cellar beneath Frankel's restaurant on King George Road in Jerusalem. It was filled with cases of canned food and bottled goods stacked halfway to the ceiling, and it was dark except for the light from a single light bulb. Avedan offered no handshake as Akiva entered, flanked by two Maccabees. It had been 5 long years since the two men had seen each other. Akiva looked in his 60s and more. The long, hard years of building 2 kibbutzim and the more recent years of underground living had turned him into an old man. The room was cleared of Maccabee and Haganah guards. The two men faced each other. At last, Avedan spoke.
I have come quite simply to ask you to call a truce with the British until the war is over.
Akiva grunted. He spat out his contempt for the British and their white paper, and his anger at the Yishuv Central and Haganah for their failure to fight.
Please, Akiva, Avedan said, holding his temper. I am aware of all your feelings. I know exactly what differences there are between us. Despite them, Germany is a far greater enemy and threat to our existence than the British.
Akiva turned his back on Avadan. He stood in the shadows, thinking. Suddenly he spun around and his eyes blazed as of old.
Now is the time to get the British to revoke the white paper. Now! Right now! Declare our statehood on both sides of the Jordan. Now! Hit the damned British when they're down!
Is statehood so important to us that we must gain it by contributing to a German victory?
And do you think the British will hesitate to sell us down the river again?
I think we have only one choice, to fight Germany.
Akiva paced the cement floor like a nervous cat. Tears of anger welled up in his eyes. He grunted and mumbled to himself. And at last he spoke with trembling softness.
Even as the British blockade our coast against desperate people, even as the British create a ghetto inside their army with our boys, even as they have sold us out with the white paper, even as the Yishuv puts its heart and soul into the war effort while the Arabs sit like vultures waiting to pounce, even with all this, the British are the lesser of our enemies, and we must fight with them. Very well, Avadan. The Maccabees will call a truce.
The air was filled with Akiva's hostility as the two men finally shook hands. Akiva wet his lips.
How is my brother? Barak just returned from conferences in London.
Yes. Conferences. That would be Barak. And Sarah and the children?
Avadan nodded.
You can be proud of Ari.
Ah, yes. Ari is a fine boy. A fine boy.
How does Ein Ohr look these days?
Avadan lowered his eyes.
Ein Ohr and Shoshana show the love and the sweat of the men who built them.
Avadan turned and walked toward the ladder to the trap door.
Zion shall be redeemed with judgment,
Akiva cried from the shadows of the cellar.
And the destruction of the transgressors and of the sinners shall be together, and they that forsake the Lord shall be consumed. Our day with the British will come.
Ari had changed. He was melancholy all the time. It was difficult to say exactly what had been the breaking point for him. He had carried arms since he was a boy. The tower and stockade days, Hamishmar, the raider unit, the Akko prison, the heartbreaking work for Ali Abet in Berlin, and the death of Daphne. Ari lived at Yadel and farmed and wanted to be left alone. He scarcely spoke a word. Even when the war broke out, Ari remained at Yadel. Most of his spare time was spent at the Arab village of Abu Yesha with his boyhood friend Taha, who was now the Mukhtar. One day, several months after the war had begun, Ari returned one evening from the fields to find Avadan himself waiting to see him. After dinner, Ari, Avadan, and Barak retired to the living room to talk.
I suppose you know why I came?
Avadan said.
I can imagine. Let me get right to the point. There are a few dozen of our boys that we feel should join up. The British have contacted Haganah half a dozen times and asked for you. They are willing to give you an officer's commission.
I'm not interested.
They want you badly, Ari. I'm sure we can put you into a position, say, Arab intelligence, where you could be of great value to the Haganah, too.
That's very nice. I thought they'd have me shoveling garbage with the rest of the Yishuv troops. It's good to know I'm one of the good Jews.
Don't make me issue this to you as an order,
You may be surprised if you do.
Avedon, who was an iron disciplinarian, was somewhat taken aback. Ari Ben Kanan had been as reliable and unquestioning a soldier as any in the Haganah.
I'm glad this is in the open, Barak said. This boy has been eating his heart out since his return from Berlin.
Ari, I'm afraid we are going to have to insist upon it.
Why should I wear a British uniform? So they can throw me into prison again for bearing arms for them?
Barak threw up his hands.
All right, father. If you want it in the open. 5 years ago, Uncle Akiva had the courage to name our enemy.
You are not to mention his name in this house,
Barak roared. It's about time it was mentioned. I might even have joined the Maccabees, except that I would not go against you.
But Ari,
Avedon said quickly, even Akiva and the Maccabees have called a truce with the British. Ari turned and started for the door.
I'll be playing backgammon at Taha's house. Call me if the Germans invade.
The German avalanche thundered across Europe. The British suffered one debacle after another. Dunkirk, Crete, Greece. London underwent merciless bombing. Even as the Yishuv poured its energy into the British war effort, it was forced to swallow degradation by the British. A series of unbelievably horrible events occurred which rankled in the hearts of even the most benevolent Jews. A pathetic 50-foot Danube riverboat named the Struma crept into Istanbul, loaded with nearly 800 frantic Jews trying to escape from Europe. The boat was unsafe and the people in dire straits. Yishuv Central literally begged the British for visas. The British refused. In fact, they turned heavy diplomatic pressure on the Turkish government to get the Struma out of Istanbul. Turkish police boarded the Struma and towed it through the Bosphorus and cut it adrift in the Black Sea without food, water, or fuel. The Struma sank. 799 human beings drowned. One survived. Two battered steamers reached Palestine with 2,000 refugees, and the British quickly ordered them transferred to the Patria for exile to Mauritius, an island east of Africa. The Patria sank off Palestine's shores in sight of Haifa, and hundreds of refugees drowned. And so it went. The British clung to the white paper. The Arabs had to be kept calm. The war continued badly for the British. By the end of 1941, Palestinian Jews had made their way into fighting units despite General Havenhurst's forebodings, for the British were desperate and they were getting no manpower at all from the Arabs. As the Arabs sat, 50,000 of the cream of the Yishuv wore British uniforms. With Western Europe crushed, German barges waited in the English Channel to invade. England had her back to the wall, and this was the moment of English glory. The Germans, who had beaten the Russians and the Greeks and the Yugoslavs, stood and balked at the showdown with those pale, scrawny wonders, the dogged Englishmen. They feared the English as they feared no others. As England had carved up the Ottoman Empire, so now the Germans prepared to carve up the British Empire. Rommel's powerful Afrika Corps was building toward a series of strikes that would throw the British out of the Middle East and open a gateway to the Orient and India. Haj Amin el-Husseini moved from Lebanon in search of greener pastures. He landed in Baghdad, Iraq, nominally a British ally, but in not much more than name. In Baghdad, he was greeted as a great martyr of Islam. He staged a coup with a gang of Iraqi army officers to deliver Iraq to the Germans. The plot failed. But only at the last moment did the British prevent it from succeeding by sending the Arab Legion in to control the country. Haj Amin fled again. This time he went to Germany, where Adolf Hitler greeted him personally as a brother. The two madmen could work through each other for mutual personal profit. The Mufti saw in Germany's military plans a new opportunity to seize power over the entire Arab world. Hitler needed the Mufti to show what a warm and tender friendship could exist between Arab and German. As a Nazi agent, Haj Amin broadcasted over and over again from Berlin to the Arab world. What he had to say, he had said many, many times before.
O Arabs, rise and avenge your martyrs. I, Mufti of Palestine, declare this war as a holy war against the British yoke of tyranny. I know the hatred you feel for them. I know you Muslims are convinced the British and the Jews are enemies of Islam and plot against the precepts of the Quran. The Jews will take our holy Islamic institutions. They even now claim a temple occupies the site of our most holy mosque of Omar, and surely they will desecrate it as they have tried before. Kill Jews wherever you find them, for this pleases God, history, and religion. This saves your honor. God is with you. Perish, Judea.
As the Mufti spoke, the Arab world seemed to heed his words. Syria and Lebanon were in the hands of Vichy French, and German materiel was pouring in to pave the way for an invasion of Palestine and Egypt. The Egyptian chief of staff sold secrets to the Germans. King Farouk of Egypt refused to give the British a single soldier for the defense of Egypt against Rommel. Further plots hatched in Iraq. The only avowed friend of the Allies was the old despot Ibn Saud, who had been bought with American dollars. But Ibn Saud did not so much as offer a single camel to the British Eighth Army, which was fighting for its life. In all the Middle East, the Allied powers had but one true fighting friend, the Yishuv. Rommel, flushed with victory in Libya, stood poised to